Welcome to NACE Clinical Highlights. I'm Dr. Greg Sherman, Chief Medical Officer at NACE. This is the second episode in a two-part series on managing residual risk in chronic kidney disease and the role of non-steroidal MRAs. Joining me is my friend and colleague, Dr. Robert Toto. Dr. Toto is the Mary M. Conroy Professor of Kidney Disease and Medical Director of the University Kidney and Liver Transplant Clinic at the UT Southwestern's Department of Internal Medicine and Associate Dean of Translational Sciences at UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, Texas. I'm glad you could join me today, Bob.
Glad to be with you again, Greg.
So, Bob, in this second podcast, we're going to move on and discuss how to incorporate the new non-steroidal MRA finerenone into our clinical practice. And in particular, we'll review appropriate candidates for finerenone and considerations on its use. It's always great to start with a case so everybody can envision the patient that they might see in their practice. So let's talk about a typical case. I'm thinking about a 58-year-old male with a 10-year history of type 2 diabetes with hypertension and diabetic kidney disease. He had a non-STEMI 6 months ago and his status post-PCI. Our labs reveal a GFR of 43, an albumin creatinine ratio of 428 milligrams per gram, and his A1C is 6.6. Blood pressure is 138 over 78. Now, when you look at his labs, his levels of GFR and albuminuria have been consistent over several months, and he currently takes lisinopril ACT 40 over 25. Amlodipine 10, rosuvastatin 20, clopidogrel 75, aspirin 81. He's on metformin 500 twice a day, and he takes a weekly GLP-1 receptor agonist. So, Bob, typical patient we're seeing, is this someone that should be a candidate for finerenone?
The short answer is yes. Well, let me elaborate a little bit on that, Greg. So now we can go inside the numbers, so as they used to say in the sports show. In the clinical trial populations of two large-scale trials that used finerenone, Fidelio and Figaro, which we discussed in our first podcast on this topic, these drugs have been approved for treating patients with type 2 diabetes, reduced GFR, and albuminuria. So this patient is definitely a candidate, so long as he doesn't have a requirement for a steroidal mineralocorticoid antagonist, and he doesn't have a history of reduced ejection fraction heart failure despite STEMI, so he is a candidate for finerenone. In the case study that you presented, our patient has type 2 diabetes, well, moderately reduced GFR, I would say, but he has severely elevated albuminuria. And severe elevation of albuminuria, which we now call albuminuria above 300 milligrams per milligram of creatinine, is considered very high albuminuria. That's actually the new terminology. And this guy's clearly well above 300. He is on an ACE inhibitor and, in fact, is on an optimized dose. That's a maximum dose in terms of benefit from the lisinopril that he's on. So no question, finerenone could be considered in this patient. Now, if he did not have diabetes or did not have albuminuria, he would not be a candidate for finerenone. That's pretty clear. So the reason to add finerenone in this patient would be to help reduce his risk for adverse cardiovascular and kidney outcomes, as demonstrated in the major clinical trials, the Fidelio DKD and the Figaro DKD study. And in those trials, the benefit of the drug in terms of their heart outcomes was accompanied by a reduction in albuminuria in the patients who received the finerenone as compared to placebo. One of the things that's important to mention about the use of finerenone or employing that in your practice is that if you find a patient who's a candidate for finerenone, you want to make sure to measure a serum potassium level and then before you start the drug, because if they were hyperkalemic, you'd want to withhold finerenone until you could get the potassium under control. Because although it's only going to, in the trials, the average increase in finerenone versus placebo was really pretty small, about 0.25 5 or so milliequivalents per liter, you want to know what the patient's potassium is before you start any dose of finerenone. Now, it's also important to remember that lifestyle modification is important in the patient that you presented. So dietary changes that could be used to help manage his blood pressure, to manage his albuminuria would be important. So what are those things? Higher blood pressure, regardless of what medication you're on, can drive albuminuria. Excess salt intake, regardless of what medications you're on, can drive albuminuria. A low salt diet, such as a DASH diet, one that's high and relatively high in fruits and vegetables, some of those are high in potassium, but we can talk about that another time. Nevertheless, getting the salt intake low and eating a healthy diet will be important for the patient that we're talking about here now. Certain medications can also increase the risk of hyperkalemia. So if you're thinking about finerenone for your patient, you want to look and see if are they taking NSAIDs, which we know can increase potassium. Are they on a potassium-sparing diuretic, such as triamterene? So want to look at those things before we move forward with a dosing finerenone.
So it sounded like this was a case where starting finerenone might have been a relatively easy choice based on the patient's potassium level to start with. But what about other medication choices? For example, in this case, should we have considered starting an SGLT2 inhibitor first? That wasn't one of his baseline medications.
Yeah, and we talked a little bit about SGLT2 inhibitors in our first podcast, and absolutely SGLT2 should be considered in this patient based on evidence from cardiorenal protection studies. And there are three major large-scale clinical trials that looked at cardiorenal protection with SGLT2 inhibitors, and they are all positive in diabetics as well as non-diabetics. So I think it's important to note that, in fact, SGLT2 inhibitors are recommended by the international clinical practice guidelines. But if a patient doesn't have to be on an SGLT2 inhibitor to start a finerenone, in fact, most of the patients who were in the Fidelio study were not, and Figaro study were not taking SGLT2 inhibitors. And even if they were, these studies have shown that even those patients who were on SGLT2 inhibitors benefited from the addition of finerenone as compared to the addition of placebo in the trial. Now, our patient is taking a GLP-1 receptor agonist to help manage his A1C and can reduce his cardiovascular risk, as cardiovascular outcomes with these agents have shown. His A1C is well within the target of less than 7% at 6.6, which is where he was. So having an SGLT2 inhibitor, while it's not necessary for glycemic control, could certainly benefit him from a cardiorenal perspective. And if the patient was taking an SGLT2 inhibitor in addition to or instead of a GLP-1 receptor agonist, so I'm modifying the case a little bit here, I would still strongly consider adding finerenone. And the reason is that if the scenario where the patient that you presented was also taking an SGLT2 inhibitor, but still has 428 milligrams per gram of albumin, I think that patient is a clear candidate for finerenone. In terms of other medications, I wanted to emphasize that, and I mentioned this in the first podcast, that the patients who've been treated with finerenone in the Fidelio and Figaro studies and the patients who've been treated with SGLT2 inhibitors in the Creedon study, in the DAPA-CKD study, and the EMPA-CKD, all of those patients were on a maximum tolerated dose of either an ACE or an ARB. So optimizing the ACE inhibitor or ARB therapy is the thing to make sure you do first before you add an SGLT2 or before you add a finerenone, before you use both of those medications. So you want to get the patient an optimum dose of the ACE inhibitor or angiotensin receptor blocker. Now, you using a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker and a diuretic to help optimize the patient's blood pressure control and a high-intensity statin, somebody who's had a non-STEMI with diabetes and chronic kidney disease, is essential. And the good news is the patient that you presented is taking maximum dose of lisinopril. He's on hydrochlorothiazide as well, amlodipine, and a pretty good dose of rosuvastatin. So I think those those things are covered, but they are really important components of the management of this patient.
I think that's all helpful, but I think I want to get a little bit more tactical with you and help our colleagues that are managing these patients and wondering what kind of considerations we might have regarding sequencing of therapies. For instance, how long should we wait between any changes to therapy once we're adding one or the other? What kind of outcomes might we expect when adding, let's say, finerenone, for example? When does the albuminuria stabilize? Does it decline? What kinds of things could you expect in practice?
You're great questions. In people with diabetic kidney disease, I think the patient characteristics really need to dictate the sequence of medications. And that's just, a holistic approach to the patient because we try to treat our patients individually. Having said that, again, our patients got excellent glycemic control. One approach that you could take would be with the patient we just presented to start with an SGLT2 inhibitor to help reduce the albuminuria and slow kidney disease progression. And in fact, kidney disease, improving global outcomes, clinical practice guidelines recommend SGLT2 inhibitors as first-line therapy along with ACE inhibitor or ARB in a patient with diabetes who has kidney disease. And if the albuminuria if the patient has albuminuria to start, which our patient does, and it persists after initiating an SGLT2 for 2 months, I'd add finerenone to help to reduce the albuminuria and to improve cardiovascular outcomes. There is still substantial residual risk, even in patients who are treated with SGLT2 inhibitors. If you look at the outcomes data from the major clinical trials, although these drugs, the SGLT2 inhibitors, reduce the risk for cardiovascular outcomes and for kidney outcomes in the diabetic patient, there's still a substantial residual risk there that a drug like finerenone could potentially address and help. And also, if there's a contraindication to an SGLT2 inhibitor, then I would go directly to adding finerenone. Now, the ACE inhibitor or angiotensin receptor blockers, I was trying to emphasize earlier, should be titrated to a maximally tolerated dose before going up. And you asked the question about what happens to the albuminuria and how frequently does it change, should we measure it? Typically, we see maximal reductions in albuminuria within 2 to 4 months after starting either an SGLT2 inhibitor or finerenone. There's a range in there. Everyone has a little bit of variability. But so what I do is I wait at least 2 months before I decide if I'm going to titrate the dose or to look to the effect that it's having on albuminuria. Obviously, it takes a lot longer for you to see a slowing of kidney disease or an outcome. And as I mentioned in the first podcast on this topic, in the Fidelio study, finerenone was associated with a 31% greater reduction in albumin from the baseline to a 4 month compared to placebo. And that persisted throughout the entire trial. I think that's what we can expect in most cases and most patients who are treated for a long period of time with a drug like finerenone.
I think that's real helpful. Great practical tools for everybody to consider when they're seeing these patients. I'm going to ask you one final question. When might we want to avoid finerenone in our practice?
Right. So as I mentioned earlier, potassium is a signal. And so if potassium is high, you can't start somebody on finerenone. And then the trials, as I mentioned, the upper limit of potassium to allow someone into the trial was 4.7 milliequivalents per liter or millimoles per liter. In my practice, I have started patients with a serum potassium as high as 5. I'm not saying that everybody should follow my practice. I'm a little more liberal because that's a little bit above the level in the trial. The point is that you would have to monitor the potassium. So I think that where you would want to avoid finerenone would be in somebody who's hyperkalemic and you can't get the potassium down to a reasonable level with either diet or use of a potassium binder or some other approach. I think that the other thing to just remind people of, although we don't see this very often, is that finerenone is contraindicated in people with adrenal insufficiency. So that's something to remember. And there are diabetics, type 2s, who have adrenal insufficiency to autoimmune phenomenon. So it's rare, but it's something we need to remember. And we also know that finerenone is contraindicated in drugs that have a strong effect on CYP3A4 inhibitors or enzymes. So drugs that inhibit that enzyme, which as everybody knows is a hepatic microsomal enzyme system that metabolizes a lot of drugs, that can raise finerenone levels. So we have to be cautious there. That's about it.
Bob, I feel so much more knowledgeable about all this just listening to you. And I want to really thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me and share your expertise on chronic kidney disease and how to really help our colleagues incorporate this emerging non-steroidal therapy into our patients with CKD and diabetes to hopefully reduce their residual risk of cardiovascular events and progression of CKD. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Greg.
If you've not heard it already, join us for the first part of our conversation, Residual Risk and CKD Impacts and Options, where Bob and I discuss the impact of mineralocorticoid receptor overactivation on cardiovascular risk and chronic kidney disease progression, and the data supporting strategies to address it. You can also go to the NACE website at naceonline.com and register for any of our other enduring activities on CKD or any other program we have developed. Please like us on Facebook and NACME to be part of our online social media community and get access to other content and programs we share. And finally, I want to thank you, our audience, for joining us for this podcast. I hope you've learned something new you can bring back to your practice. We look forward to having you join us for other upcoming podcasts in the future.